Hello and welcome to the Consistency Project with EC Sinkowski. My name is Patrick Cummings, and every episode I have the privilege of having a discussion with EC on subject matters that range from nutrition to fitness to the choices we can all make to live a healthier, more functional life. By exploring both the principles at play and the actions worth carrying out as a result, it is our goal to get you thinking, get you moving, and get you taking more consistent steps toward optimizing your well-being. Thank you, as always, for tuning into the show. Hello, and how are you, EC?
Great. How are you?
Great. I'm great. We're going to talk about dairy and its role or lack of in inflammation.
Yes.
Very, very exciting.
Hot
Where
topic.
To begin, oftentimes we begin with definitions. So maybe we define both these terms, dairy and inflammation. Maybe first one first, let's go with dairy.
Yeah, it's probably a good place to start. You know, we actually touched on this, I believe, in Quick Bites episode number one, you know, in defining what dairy is. I think we have to be really clear what we mean when we say dairy, because it's sort of like if somebody says they're vegan and all of a sudden you realize they're eating like plant-based Pop-Tart and cookies. It's like, okay, well, that wasn't really the intent of a vegan diet. So again, with the dairy category, when we say dairy, do we mean just like a cup of milk and some plain yogurt and cottage cheese, a little bit of cheese on salads type of stuff? Or are we talking about the processed products that are made with dairy? You know, the ice cream, the sweetened yogurt with all the candy crunchy toppings that they have, right? Pizza, cheesecakes, you name it, stuff like that. And then when we remind ourselves that 70%, over 70% of people in the U.S. are overweight, 60% of people are eating more than the recommended amount of added sugar, 70% are eating more than the recommended amount of saturated fat, 80% of people aren't eating enough fruits and vegetables. You know, if I were to paint with a broad brush on people's diets, when they go to exclude all dairy from their diet, I'm guessing a lot of this processed stuff goes with it, the ice cream, the chocolate, whatever, you know, the mozzarella sticks, et cetera. And so we have to get really clear in our mind what we're saying dairy is. Is it truly dairy, like a cup of milk, yogurt is the problem? Or is it all of the extra carb and fat calories in processed foods that may contain dairy that is? And I'm going to wager it's the latter. And so that's what we have to think about when we think about the what about dairy. It might not just be showing up in the diet in the terms of like the coffee creamer, right? It probably is in a lot of other products that are quite common. And so this is when people switch to paleo, you know, they find out that a lot of other things besides the cheese go.
Right. Okay. Inflammation. Let's define that too.
Yeah. We've tackled this a couple times. Pretty complicated topic. I think the best way that I've come up so far to try to explain it in a useful way, it's the immune system response to try to bring the body back to homeostasis or back to normal functioning. And I think really also trying to push back on this idea that inflammation is always bad, that what seems to be out there is sort of like kind of the messaging around us, around it. It's necessary. It's life-saving. You want inflammation when you have a virus, an infection after an injury. That's the immune system healing you, bringing you back to homeostasis. And even exercise is inflammatory, right? Because there's some damage there. But no one is saying to stop exercise because it's inflammatory. So we have to understand that there's times when inflammation can be good. And a lot of times inflammation is good when it's this acute inflammation. I mean, good in the sense of it's healing, not that we necessarily want an injury or an infection. But when we have this acute inflammation or a short-term amount, it's a transient rise in the immune system response. And that's not really what I think people fear when we hear about inflammation in the diet out there. It's this long-term, persistent, chronic inflammation that we generally fear or care about when we hear about inflammation in the mainstream, because that's linked to our chronic diseases like cardiovascular disease, diabetes, et cetera. And it makes sense to have chronic inflammation with these chronic diseases, because again, if it's an immune system response trying to get us back to normal, if you have cardiovascular disease, the immune system is like trying to fix the issue that's going on. And so we just have to remember that when we have the presence of inflammation, when we have the presence of these signaling molecules or cells of the immune system, it doesn't inherently tell us that it's always a bad chronic disease condition. And so to kind of keep that in mind, that there's going to be cases of inflammation that aren't necessarily, oh my gosh, everything needs to change in my diet.
All right, got it. So in advance of this conversation, as you sometimes do, you sent me a couple things that we want to make sure we touch on. So you sent me four ways to talk about dairy as it relates to inflammation. I'm going to go through each one of these. First one's going to be weight gain. Second one's allergy. Third is GI distress. And the fourth is delayed hypersensitivity. So again, first thing first, weight gain. Let's talk about dairy, weight gain, and inflammation.
Yeah, I think this is the one of the four areas that you just listed, in which dairy is likely associated with this low-grade chronic inflammation that I think people are worried about, but it's not specific to dairy per se. We already kind of alluded to it. It's specific to eating too much. And I don't want to spend much more time on it, because I know we've kind of already said that here and we've said it elsewhere. But, you know, when I say people are eating too much, I think sometimes people freak out, you know, oh my gosh, I had a birthday and I ate too much ice cream and now I'm inflamed. I don't mean that. Like, I don't mean in one single sitting. I mean, eating too much in the sense of excess across weeks, months, such that we now have extra weight on the body. And this is how vegetable oils, too much sugar, potentially even dairy could be, quote, inflammatory. It's when we overeat these processed foods that are so commonplace in the diet, and then we have subsequent weight gain. It's that weight gain that's inflammatory. And that's because the fat cells grow in size. That growth in size triggers this inflammatory response. That's inflammation. So in a very, very broad way, I'm sure that dairy products and the way that they show up in people's diets could be contributing to chronic inflammation, but it's really related to quantity. It's not specific to dairy. And that's what we see in research regarding inflammation and dairy. In studies that are looking specifically at inflammatory markers, there was a 2017 review by Bordoni in the show notes that, in summary of these 52 clinical trials, the weight of the evidence suggests that dairy is anti-inflammatory. Again, looking at these signaling molecules that are associated with inflammation in the immune system. And then more recently, there was a systematic review and meta-analysis in 2019, also in the show notes. They were looking at 16 studies. Their conclusion was the consumption of milk or dairy products did not show a pro-inflammatory effect in healthy subjects or in individuals with metabolic abnormalities. The majority of studies documented a significant anti-inflammatory effect in both healthy and metabolically abnormal subjects, although not all articles were of high quality, which we know of research. But I think that's really important to point out that it wasn't just in healthy subjects. They were also looking at people who already had, let's say, metabolic syndrome, type 2 diabetes. They still found that dairy was anti-inflammatory. And then that's just, again, looking at the signaling molecules of the immune system. If we kind of go more long-term and look at, okay, what happens when we look at dairy consumption relative to these chronic diseases, cardiovascular disease, cancer, even death risk, stuff like that, we find that dairy does not increase the risk of those chronic diseases. So if the inflammation that we generally care about is associated with these chronic diseases, and dairy is not associated with these chronic diseases, I don't think that dairy is causing this inflammation, especially then once you combine it with this knowledge of these other studies of the cell signaling molecules I just mentioned. Mm-hmm. Now, you might be asking, well, how does that square with all this stuff that you just said about people eating dairy as pizza and dairy as ice cream? Well, in these studies, when they look at what dairy is, they consider dairy, you know, typically like a cup of plain milk and a cup of yogurt and stuff like that. When they add dairy to somebody's diet, they're not like, eat an extra large pizza. It's typically like, here's a cup of skim milk. And so when we do stuff like that, when we give people a cup of skim milk, it might actually be displacing something like, you know, a soda or something like that. So it could actually be a healthy effect on the diet. And so that's why I have a feeling that when we consider dairy, the plain yogurt and the, you know, whatever cup of milk, that's not really what's causing the weight gain. But yet we have this dichotomy with how dairy often shows up in people's diets. And that may, of course, be part of this excess intake, therefore weight gain, and therefore potentially low-grade inflammation.
Okay. That was weight gain. The second one was an allergy.
Yeah.
How is this related to inflammation?
Yeah. So definitely an allergy is inflammatory, but again, it's not going to be this chronic inflammation, chronic disease that tends to be kind of mentioned so much in the mainstream. Now, the words allergy, intolerance, sensitivity tend to be thrown around a lot and often used kind of ubiquitously or synonymously, that's the word I'm looking for, and potentially used incorrectly. And when we hear the word allergy, we're really talking about what we call an IgE response, IgE being a specific type of antibody. And these allergic reactions often happen within minutes of exposure to a protein in a food, and they can range from mild to severe reactions. We can be talking about things like hives, stuffy nose, itching, swelling of the tongue or the lips or the throat, difficulty breathing type stuff. It can also be GI symptoms, diarrhea, cramping, and also skin conditions. This is where we might see something like eczema. But when this gets really severe, there is actually the risk of death. This is the EpiPen anaphylactic shock potential risk. And dairy is one of the most common allergens. It's one of the 8 major food allergens, the other ones being eggs, fish, shellfish, tree nuts, peanuts, wheat, and soybeans. And so we have regulations in the US that these really have to be labeled on products because there really is a high risk here for people that are truly allergic. Mm-hmm. Now, what's interesting, while dairy is one of the most common allergens, it's actually not that common on an absolute population sense. So milk allergy is more common in children. About 2-3% of children under 3 are allergic to milk, but then we tend to grow out of it. So that means that the percentage of adults is actually less than 2-3%. So it's common in the sense of when you have an allergy, it tends to be this, but it's mm-hmm. not common in the sense of when we look at the whole population that most people have it. Now, yes, an allergy has an immune response, it has inflammation, and it can be chronic, but it also can be acute. But again, it's not really this inflammation in the sense of causing cardiovascular disease or causing metabolic syndrome. And, you know, it's kind of funny. It's like, I feel like you hear dairy and inflammation all the time, but if we were talking about it in the sense of this allergic mechanism, we would also hear, well, salmon is inflammatory. You shouldn't eat salmon, right? Because people are really allergic to fish too, but we don't really hear that. Yet that is also a common mechanism for allergy here. So, you know, we instead about fish, it's like, well, if you're allergic, don't eat it. Well, same thing here. If you're allergic to dairy, don't eat it. But it's not because we're worried about, you know, again, it leading to then cardiovascular disease, et cetera.
Gotcha. Okay. So the third one is or was GI distress.
Yeah. This is the one that I think is why most people have this negative response to dairy. But again, mm-hmm. it's not something to worry about in terms of low-grade chronic inflammation leading to our chronic diseases. Most of the GI distress that we have for people is due to lactose intolerance. And so intolerance refers to the symptoms that result when we don't have the ability to digest and absorb lactose, which is the sugar in milk. And so when you don't digest and absorb lactose, it continues through the GI tract and gets to the colon. The microbes in the colon, the living bacteria there, they may ferment it, they may use it for energy, and so a byproduct of which is gas, so then we might have more gas. Or simply having the presence of lactose in the colon can also draw water into the colon. So you might have more gas there, you might also just have more water in the colon. That's not so great too, because that could end up being diarrhea. So, mm-hmm. and sometimes there can be pain as well from this increased pressure there. But all of this stuff is kind of localized, or is, I shouldn't say kind of, to the GI tract. And it's temporary in the sense of when you have lactose present there. So again, it's not this long-term systemic throughout the body inflammation. Now, I guess interestingly enough, you know, some of these symptoms of lactose intolerance do overlap with allergy because of this potential for diarrhea, GI distress. But I think just based on prevalence numbers and the way that we would test things, that most adults are going to be more likely to be lactose intolerant just based on numbers, as I mentioned already with the percentages, and the fact that as a child, there's so much dairy exposure that you're probably going to be tested. So this is why mm-hmm. typically you're going to be lactose intolerant if you have the GI distress as an adult, not that you're now discovering a new allergy, but still you can always go to an allergist, immunologist. And so really what happens is, you know, lactose is in human breast milk. We do have the ability to digest it. It does require the enzyme lactase to break it down, and its production of that enzyme declines with age. How much it declines and really varies, but also varies with ethnicities. Generally, people from Northern European descent, they tend to have more lactase persist throughout their life, where people from Asian or African or Native American descent tend to not have a lot of lactase. Now, what's interesting, though, is that doesn't always tell us whether or not somebody has symptoms. So you might not have as much lactase, but you might not also develop these symptoms either. So we end up having this huge range in what people experience when they consume dairy. And I just want to mention that because this is so common, and because also given our audience has a lot of kind of functional fitness enthusiasts, probably having a lot of whey protein in here. Whey protein, of course, is the protein, but oftentimes whey protein has lactose in it as just part of the product, you know, as they're kind of separating it out from milk. And so for people who have GI distress from having whey protein, if they try to find a whey protein isolate, oftentimes this has less lactose, just as an FYI, because I know that's of interest to this group. Now, one more thing on GI distress. We're not done yet, Patrick. Yes, it seems to be that lactose intolerance is the most common, but it turns out there can also be GI distress from proteins in milk. So lactose, again, is the sugar. Milk also has different types of protein, the major ones being whey and casein. In cow's milk, there is two types of this casein protein. They're called A1 and A2. I'm sure some of our audience has heard about this. When the A1 is digested, it can end up producing symptoms similar to lactose intolerance. And so this would be, again, from the proteins, not necessarily the lactose. But again, it's still not this systemic inflammation that's going to result in insulin resistance, metabolic syndrome, et cetera. The main takeaway here is if you feel like you have GI stuff after dairy, you don't have to have dairy. A lot of times you might find some alleviation by switching the products because, again, it might be lactose. So maybe you'll do better off with things that don't have as many carbs in them, maybe better with cheese, maybe fine with butter type of stuff, maybe doing a whey protein isolate, as I mentioned. But then if you find that you still have it with the protein stuff, okay, you don't have to have that either. But it's again, not like I had a pizza, I had bloating and gas, and now I'm giving myself insulin resistance. No, it's not the same mechanism to worry about at all.
Got it. Okay. The fourth, final and fourth is hypersensitivity.
Yeah. Okay. So I think this is one that people think they have related to chronic inflammation, but it's unlikely that it's a real issue. So we're talking about delayed food hypersensitivity. Unlike an allergy that typically presents quite quickly after consumption, this one could present with symptoms a couple days after exposures. And there's lots of these different food sensitivity tests on the market that measure what's called IgG antibodies to food proteins. Now, IgG antibodies are normal responses to your diet. And these tests that do these measurements of them, they're testing the amount of IgG you have present to say that you're sensitive to this food and that this might explain, I don't know, your bloating, your fatigue, acne, migraines, weight gain. I mean, they have a whole host of things that they're going to say they're going to fix when you figure out what foods you're sensitive to. What's really unfortunate about this, it appears that IgG doesn't correlate with intolerance or sensitivity, I should really say. It actually correlates with tolerance, meaning your immune system tolerates these food proteins. It's not a negative inflammatory response at all. And so this is why many times after these tests, you'll hear people who get these like results in quotes that they're telling them they're sensitive to like eggs and raspberries. And then they're like, oh my gosh, well, I eat eggs and raspberries every day. And it's like, yes, because your body has developed tolerance to them. And this is why the IgG antibodies are showing up and in your system. And so there's this great paper by John Kelso that just kind of puts a slam dunk on all this junk science diet advice, especially with these food sensitivity tests. But I think he does a really good job of summarizing in part why these become so popular. You know, people do have very real symptoms. I'm not doubting that people have the symptoms, but it's really hard to always figure out what's going on. And a lot of things aren't necessarily because of the diet. And so they go to conventional medicine. And conventional medicine can't diagnose it. They don't have a treatment for it. And so then they try all these alternative tests and alternative practitioners, and they're told that they have an answer. They're told that here's the reason why you have these ailments. And having an answer for a lot of people, even if it's the wrong one, is very healing. It's the placebo effect. And of course, you know, in some cases that can be great. And in other cases, it can lead to all these food neuroses and even nutritional deficiencies because people are like, I'm never eating eggs and raspberries again, or whatever other things show up on their tests. And they end up this really obscure diet of like lamb and rice, you know? And so that's the unfortunate thing about these tests. It's really not good science. You know, even the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma and Immunology, as well as the European Academy of Allergy and Clinical Immunology, as well as the Canadian Society of Allergy and Clinical Immunology, none of them recommend these tests. And yet there's no shortage of them on the market, making millions of dollars for people giving junk science advice.
So where then did the, I don't know if fear is the right word, but the trepidation around dairy come from? Do we have any sense of that? Or is there any other fears that we maybe should be aware of or talk about?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to put all of the blame on one person.
Let's do it. Let's blame one person. What's his phone number?
But let's try. No, I mean, just in my own experience, I'm guessing for you too, just because we kind of came up through CrossFit at the same time. I mean, I certainly became fearful of it with the paleo movement, right? So I was just sort of thinking about, well, let me go to paleodiet.com and just see what they say about dairy. You know, what was the evidence again? What's the rationale? And they do have a lot of different points beyond what I'm going to say here. But it opens pretty much with this whole premise that our ancestors didn't eat it, so why should we? You know, we only started including dairy 10,000 years ago, which, you know, not long in the evolution sense. But it's just a faulty line of reasoning. I mean, what does that have to do with anything? Like, that doesn't, just because they didn't eat it doesn't mean that it's harmful. You know, our ancestors didn't use antibiotics, but they've saved countless lives today. I mean, we could go on and on with those different examples. Another point, and I remember this when I was, you know, very strict paleo, is that, you know, and this is quoted from the website, we are the only species on the planet to consume another animal's milk throughout our adult lives. And they say it as though it's so negative. And again, it's like, what does this have to do with anything? We're the only species that builds spacecraft and send ourselves to the moon. I mean, are we going to wait for another mammal to do that? Like, so again, it's just sort of like, I don't really know that that proves anything. You know, another thing that they point out is it's like, oh my gosh, it's up to 10% of calories in the diet. And it's like, okay, well, I have 10% of calories to spend on something else besides fruits and vegetables and besides protein. Like, that doesn't really make me that concerned. So, yeah, I mean, I think those kind of big things that these talking points that come with the paleo diet just don't really make any sense or any real scientific reason to cut it out. There's also some concerns out there. And this wasn't directly from the website, but I've just heard it before that people feel like they get a lot more mucus or kind of phlegm when they have dairy. There's actually been controlled trials that show that this does not happen. And so I think it's one of these cases, again, where we hear stuff in the blogosphere and then we have that response because we're conditioned to have that response. There's also concern about, what about the hormones in milk? We actually talked about this in the organic podcast, but the level that you're exposed to is so much less than what you produce naturally. Even if you were to compare it to what young men produce naturally, who have the lowest level of estrogen, for example, and that's typically the one that we care about. So yeah, I mean, I think there's this attraction to these conspiracy theories, like Big Ag is trying to kill us. You know, the government's trying to kill us and all of this stuff. And I think it's attractive because it's almost like our defense mechanisms telling us like, okay, I know the right answer. You know, they're not going to fool me. They're not going to pull one over on me. So those continue to persist, but it's like the reason why this food exists in our food supply is because it's been determined to be safe. There's also been all these claims about raw milk is more healthy. I'll have a link in the show notes to an FDA website. They do a great job just going blow by blow on all the claims that it's not better in terms of your immune system, that it's not better in terms of health, you know, that it's not better in terms of safety. And so I just want to link to that because to just try to go through all of that, you know, there's no reason to. I think we also mentioned this on a podcast before on like trying to understand good information from worse information. And I think we just have to be open to the possibility that status quo is status quo because many smart people before us made that to be the best solution, right? Status quo doesn't always mean, you know, herd mentality. And sometimes it's just lots and lots of people have already looked at the problem and this is the best outcome we have so far, right?
It's kind of like cliches where like everybody uses them, but everybody uses them because they tend to be true.
Right.
And we cast them aside as that's just a cliche. It's like, well, yeah, but it's because it persists because it continues to be true.
Totally. I think, you know, people want to be contrarian, people want to be iconoclast. And it's like, well, maybe there was something in the reason to not be that. I will kind of wrap this section up with, there is probably one concern that shows some slight evidence, and that is dairy and acne. There does seem to be an increased association with people who have acne as well as dairy consumption. And there's a 2019 meta-analysis by Agassi in the show notes, and they found a positive relationship between dairy, total milk, whole milk, low fat, and skim milk consumption with acne occurrence. The problem is they did not find a significant association between yogurt and cheese and acne. So it's like, well, if yogurt has proteins in it and yogurt has lactose in it and yogurt has fat in it, well, how the heck is that not associated with dairy, but milk is? And so I feel like there's still a lot to be determined about, like, why is this association there? You know, we all know the limitations of association studies. What are other factors in these people's diet and lifestyle that might be the driving factor, not necessarily just the dairy proteins, for example? But certainly if somebody has acne and they want to try removing dairy, if it resolves it, great for them. But also if it does not resolve it, I wouldn't think I have to keep dairy out of my diet forever, because it certainly is not proven that that will be therapeutic in all cases.
Got it. Okay. Maybe starting to wrap up, maybe a little talk about the practical side of things, if you've got anything for us.
Yeah. I mean, I think kind of what we led off with, it's like, kind of think about how dairy shows up in your life. Like, if you're going to exclude all dairy in your diet, is it just like a cup of milk a day or the plain yogurt, or do a lot of snack foods go with it? You know, look at the ingredient list of some of those processed foods. I think people will be surprised at how frequent dairy is in a lot of them. And so maybe when you cut out dairy, you end up cutting out a lot of crap, and therefore it's not the dairy. It's the crap that was the issue. Of course, this one's pretty obvious. If you're allergic, you're going to stay away. But you probably already know this. And if you're not sure, definitely go to an MD or a DO to get a proper diagnosis on that. And yeah, you do the skin prick tests and they're valid, and that's why they've been using them forever, and they can help you out for sure. If you have GI stuff after dairy, and you don't want to have GI stuff after dairy, you don't have to eat it. Thankfully, it's not leading to any chronic disease in that sense. You don't have to worry about kind of long-term harm. I would think about maybe playing around with dose and type of dairy, as we kind of mentioned. Like, maybe you can't handle a liter of milk in a sitting, but maybe a cup of milk is fine. Most people can handle up to that amount. Maybe you'll do better with whey protein versus isolate versus concentrate. Maybe butter is fine, cheese is not. So there probably can be some flexibility there for a lot of people, instead of I have to exclude all dairy, although some ultimately will. But again, ultimately, if you don't feel good GI-wise, fine, cut it out. And then, like I said, also maybe acne, worth a shot, but certainly not evidence to say that it will be therapeutic in all cases. And lastly, stay away from those food sensitivity tests, Patrick.
Can we do an episode on that?
We probably have to.
We can't lay the gauntlet down like that and then not readdress it. But
I know.
But super interesting. Okay. Yeah. Thank you, EC. Thank you, everybody out there, for listening. Thank you for your ratings and your reviews. EC and I will be back next week for another episode of The Consistency Project.